Okay. All right. Good evening. Thanks for coming. All right. So first, two sources that I used. So one is actually I didn't bring, but the in Rabbi Talushkin's biography of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he has a couple of notes about these stories, so to put some of that in. There is an incredible book. I have found it to be fascinating. It's the book Who Will Lead Us. It actually came out in the last couple of months, which gave me the idea for this. It goes through five Hasidic dynasties. Samuel Heilman, who's I think a professor at Queens College, or Brooklyn College. Heilman, H-E-I-L-M-A-N. So it goes through Munkach, Bian, Babov, Satmar, and then Chabad. Those two all five about how things transition, and specifically how they're able to transition. How they're able to transition in America. He points out two of them had problems of no successors, two of them had problems of too many successors, and then one group claimed they didn't need a successor at all. So that would be the last chapter. That's how he introduces this book. So he has a couple, but he really goes through from the beginning of the various transitions. Chabad has a long history of challenging transitions from one Rebbe to the next. And then there is another book out there, which I came across, and then I found a reference to it, and I think it came up actually on Google Books, something from it. I wondered, hey, I wonder if anybody around here has this book. So the book, The Heroic Struggle, which then I found after emailing a couple of our Chabad shluchim around here, if any of them had it, they all said we do, and like it's pretty much found in every Chabad home, right? Do you have this in your house?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, okay.
We're
so
happy to have blended to you.
Right, so thank Rabbi Nissen Moskowitz for lending me his copy. But it goes through this particular story, so it really goes from the Rebbe's own, not necessarily his own notes, but from various sichot that were given later on. It goes through his challenge. So, all right. So where do we begin? So really, one should really begin from the previous Rebbe. So the title tonight is the Frier. We talked about the Frier Dicker Rebbe. Frier Dicker Rebbe is Yiddish for the previous Rebbe. He's also known as the Rebbe Rayatz, Rav Yaakov, Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. He is the son of Rav Shalom Dov Ber Schneerson, known as the Rashab, who was the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he was the, and at that point there actually were a few. He was actually a Rebbe in Lubavitch. There were several other descendants of the Tzemach Tzedek, not Tzemach Tzedek, of the Tzemach Tzedek, who had claimed various rabbinical ships, their own crowns of Chabad, but he's sort of seen as the one who took over from the one who at least the Tzemach Tzedek had officially said that you were going to become Rebbe. So then that's Rav Shmuel, and then comes the Rashab, and then comes the Rayat. So Rav Shalom Dover was the Rebbe at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. From what I could tell, he had, and we think today, we think of Chabad as sort of, we don't think of Chabad as, oh yeah, there's like Babov, Munkach, and Chabad. Like, we don't really put them in the same category. But at that time, it was. At that time, there was a sect of Hasidim. Babov was in Hungary. Satmar was also a different part of Hungary. Lubavitch was up in Russia. And that was the Hasidic sect that existed in Russia. In northeastern Russia, close to Lithuania, Chabad was known always as being somewhat learned. They were connected to the Lithuanian world somewhat, so they're known as being Tamid Chacham, etc. All of those things, and that's important to rec- kind of the kind of to have that frame of mind. This was a sect of Hasidim that controlled that area of the world, so to speak. Chabad actually traces themselves back to the Alter Rebbe. They're probably, in terms of their direct tracing, they could probably go earlier than anybody else. They go to the Alter Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe was a student of the student, I believe, right, of the Baal Shem Tov. He was not in Lubavitch, he was Liade, but the founder of Chabad Chasidus is the Shulchan Aruch Rav, etc., and they trace themselves directly back to him. Okay, so Rav Shalom Dov Ber One, he invoked the issue of messianism, the idea of the strong messianism that we see from Chabad today traces itself to him. He was also, like most of the rabbis at the time, opposed Zionism. He opposed that we should go back. He took, from what I could tell, took what we refer to as like the soccer stand, as we know it as today, as we can't do it. The only thing we could do to bring the Mashiach is to do more mitzvahs and to acquire more zechusim and to go out and do outreach and try to recruit as many Jews to do mitzvahs as possible. But for us to politically or to militarily, for sure not, to go and try to conquer Eretz Yisrael, that's something that's certainly not within our purview. And that time, the end of the 1800s, the beginning of the 1900s, was a very challenging time. That was already the time when somehow Haskalah had come in. That was already the beginning of the Bolshevik Revolution took place under his period. World War I took place under his domain. In fact, during World War I, he left the town of Lubavitch. He had to run away from the town of Lubavitch, run away from the Germans, and moved to a town called Rostov, or Rostov on Don. That's the way it's known. I guess Don River is River. There, right? So it was the town called Rostov, and that's where he held his rabbinic court until he passed away in 1920. So him running away from the Germans matches the Alter Rebbe having to run away from the Germans. That was the famous machlokas that involves actually the Soloveitchik family, where there was a big machlokas. Are we going to be pro-French, or are we going to be pro-Russian, or are we going to be pro-Napoleon or pro-Russian? There, some of Levi Yitzchak Mibarditchev was on the side that we should support the French because they'll give the Jews freedom and things will be wonderful and we'll be able to get out of this oppressiveness against religion. While the Alter Rebbe famously sided with the on the Russian side, was anti-Napoleon and ran away, and that's where he stayed in the town of Koslovich, and the Misnagdish Rav of Koslovich hid the Rebbe, even though they were supposedly opposition. And the Russian, when the French soldiers came for him, he said, "What, you think I would hide the Hasidish Rebbe here? If I knew he was here, I'd kill him myself, or I'd hand him in myself." And so he saved the Rebbe's life. And the tradition in Koslovich was that they would always have a Litvisher Rav, even though it was a mostly Chabad town, and that Litvisher Rav eventually ended up being Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and that's why the Rav, Rav Yosef Soloveitchik, was born in that town. So a similar thing happened later on, that he was running, he sided with the Russians against the Germans in World War I, had to run away and reestablish himself. Now, with that type of royalty to the Russian government, be able to pay dividends for him later on? So, absolutely not. Right? That was not going to happen. He ended up passing away in 1920. He left his only son remaining. His only son was Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, who is the main topic of our talk tonight. And he took over the Chassidim. There were a few sort of outliers within the Chabad movement, as you mentioned before, that had taken other rabbis. He consolidated the entire movement very quickly, partly because no one else really wanted the job. It was a very challenging time. The Bolshevik Revolution was already in full swing and had already shifted somewhat towards the anti-Semitism that was about to come, but he claimed that he probably started his being Rebbe in a more difficult situation than any Rebbe that came before him, or I guess you would also say the one that came after him as well.
About how many followers did you
have? Yeah, that's a good question. I assume thousands. You're talking about really the Jewish population of an area that had a lot of Jews in it. So thousands, and it wasn't like he was competing with another Rebbe. People really claimed territory in those days. He talks about it in this in his introduction to the book, Who Will Lead Us. He points out that originally there were rebbes in certain areas, and you were connected to that area, and then you left that area. It wasn't like you became a chassid of that. There's no, for instance, his example is there's no Berditchev or chassidim anymore. I mean, if you lived in Berditchev at the time, you were a chassid of Rav Levi Yitzchak, and then you moved someplace else, or then they waited for someone else with enough charisma to come to town. And if not, so then you found someone else. It was the way we have today of, I trace my family to this specific tradition, that didn't really exist in the early period of Hasidus. That came later on. And people also didn't move around that much those days either. What were his main challenges that he was confronting when he took over to become the Lubavitch Rebbe in 1920, even though it wasn't in the town of Lubavitch? But he had this overall secularism. There was still a possibility of Jews leaving, so there were a lot of Jews ever leaving. There was the promise of communism that the Jewish people would be free, which is a lot of competition for the Rebbe to be able to deal with. And but he did move. So pretty early on, he moved from where he was in this town, Rostov, and he moved to St. Petersburg, which has already been changed its name to Leningrad. So he set up shop in Leningrad, hoping that he'd be... Now, I don't know if that was seen later on as a mistake or not, because I think he moved it because there are a lot of Jews there, and the Russians are being pleasant to us for a little bit. So maybe he hoped to build up his court in Leningrad, but very soon became clear that this was not going to last. His friendliness to the Jews wasn't gonna continue. Yeah.
When you said you had to deal with the problem of Jews leaving, is it leaving the Soviet Union to go to other parts of Eastern Europe, or is it leaving to go to America and/or Palestine?
I think my impression is more B than A, but I think A also. Well, Western Europe is always more promising economically.
I mean, other, like Poland's.
So I don't know. I don't know if Poland, if there's really much to gain by going to Poland over Russia at that particular moment. But certainly they were trying to get to Western Europe, America, and Israel also. That for
so
sure it was competing
in,
with.
In our discussion of Rabbi Schneerson, are we accepting that the Jews leaving in 1920 is a problem, or are we simply looking at it from his perspective?
Oh, from his perspective, I don't know if it was a problem.
From his perspective, it's a problem.
Well, it was a problem in that most people that went to America ended up not being from. And most people that went to Israel ended up not being from. And there was a challenge of Zionism that he was confronting. Zionism meant secular Zionism at that time. Mm-hmm. So that was, A, that was a challenge because... you're a rabbinic leader, you want everybody to be religious. B, it was a challenge because you need Hasidim around.
You could suffer a decrement in income.
Sure. And that became more pronounced as the communist regime started tightening its grip. So officially, they never banned Judaism. That it never was officially on the books that you're not allowed to be Jewish. What did become problematic is operating large schools and transferring money around and communicating with the outside world. So those things were problematic. And ultimately, but within the Communist Party, there was a group. They were known as the, I could pronounce this right, Yevsektsia. Did I say that right?
Yevsekia.
Or Tsia? There's a T and S in there also. But that was the Jewish movement within the Communist Party that was really attempting to squash Judaism. I mean, this is made up mostly of Jews and people whose parents were Hasidim, people whose parents were Rebbes, joined this group. And they saw it as, in order for communism to succeed, we have to squash Jews, and they knew exactly what to do. They grew up in this, or their parents grew up in this. They knew all the tricks. They knew where everybody was hiding. They knew how things get passed on from generation to generation. They knew all this stuff. And that became a very dangerous group that was operating within the communist movement. And besides just that they felt that it was a good idea, they also felt that by the more Jews they could turn in, the more their own personal standing will rise within the will rise within that party.
As a parallel, the non-Hasidic Jews that were there were probably
there weren't any. It was not really.
Relatively.
If you were a Jew that lived there, you were a chassid, I think.
Okay.
That's my impression. So. So they ended up closing 1,000 schools. I saw 650 shuls were closed during this period of just attempting to close things up. And most rebbes fled. Most rebbes left. They left, A, because it was dangerous, and B, because... either Hasidim left, but also the Hasidim who were wealthy that were supporting these rebbes were stripped of their businesses. Right, it was a communist takeover. They lost all of their money, and there was nothing to support them with. So they ran away along with their Hasidim, and the Rav Yosef Yitzchak did not leave. Rav Yosef Yitzchak stayed put in the heart of communist Russia. Well, I don't know, Moscow versus Leningrad. They probably debated that in those days. But he stayed in Leningrad, and he became now, as most of the other. So So maybe there's not much left, but there was a lot left. There were a lot of Jews, certainly, who didn't leave. And he became, really, the Rebbe for all of Russian Jewry. Right? So what does that grant you? So he also became the most prominent face to outside of Russia. So in 1914, there was an organization that was founded known as the Joint Distribution Committee, the JDC. So JDC originally was founded to support Jews that were behind enemy lines during World War I. World War I is now over, but now what Jewish organization will say, all right, well, our job is done, we'll just close down. No, that's not going to happen. So let's figure out how we could help support Jews. So the JDC looked to support Jews behind Russia, actually, as they still do, but I don't think it was known as the Iron Curtain yet, and Rav Yosef Yitzchak was the face. He was the most prominent person in Russia for them to be able to communicate with, and therefore his prestige became much more. Chabad Hasidus' prestige became a lot, as all money came into Russia through him. Now, of course, that then leads, if you have a lot of money going through your hands, so that then becomes a problem, that you become now a pretty big target in the eyes of the communists, of the Yesvekia, of that group, and he certainly became their primary target. There is, in 1922, he formed something called the Vod, which was going to be how we're going to try to maintain Judaism throughout Russia. In the year 1924, there is a prominent story that is around that he took nine young Hasidim into a room and said that are you willing to defend and support Judaism in Russia? The quote is, until the last drop of blood. That was the term that that was used, and they all took this solemn oath, and then he held hands with them and said, and I'm going to be the 10th one to the minyan, and we together are going to defend Judaism in Russia. So that was the year 1924, and that is a prominent story within Chabad Hasidus. That story is well known. I don't know if we know about what happened to the other nine people. I'm sure a bunch of them.
One survived.
There is one that survived.
Rabbi Jacobson.
Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson?
His grandfather.
Really? Ah.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
If you ever see him, you can ask him the story. I don't know for sure.
All right. So there's one known that survived. There are stories of these
unbelievable.
Of these guys. Yes, right. They went and opened schools. As soon as one was shut down, they would open up another one. There's a story that I came across that one of them showed up in Georgia, in Russian Georgia, and found that dozens of mikvahs had been closed by the Communist Party. So he forged documents. Faked from Moscow, telling the local people to reopen all the mikvahs. It's been approved by the. So what happened to these stories, and what happened to these people that were involved? So I don't know how much is known, but maybe there's more out there to discover. Okay. By the way, if you're wondering, 1923 is when Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who became the Rebbe, that was when he was introduced to the daughter of Rav Yosef Yitzchak. They did not marry until later. He sort of shows up a little bit over the course of the story. He was already known within the family. He was sort of identified as becoming the other son-in-law. There was another son. Rav Yosef Yitzchak had three daughters. One was married to, already was married to Gorari, is that how you pronounce it? Shmaryahu Gorari, who was also living with them at the time. One, Chaya Mushka, became married to Menachem Mendel later on, but again, they had started meeting already in 1923. Then there's a third daughter, who I believe died in the Holocaust, got caught, who was actually killed in Treblinka, who also got married at that point. Okay, so that gets one more in sort of setting the scene. There is a famous story from Purim 1927. At Purim in 1927, he knew that there were informers within the room, and he constantly referred to that we have strangers amongst us, we have informers amongst us, Yimach Shemam, and their name should be. He kept referring to them, and people told him, you should maybe keep it down because he's one of them, and he refused, and he kept going, and that's also a prominent story. And then that gets to the night of June 15th, 1927. The Rebbe finished Maariv at around 11:30 because June in St. Petersburg or London, right, that's when you could daven Maariv. So around 11, which became an issue when he was in jail. But at 11:30 he finished Maariv. He sat down for supper. That part, I don't... Okay. He sat down for supper with his family. There was a knock on the door. In came two prominent... they weren't KGB agents. They were at that time...
NKVD?
I think that came later. I think those approximately came later. But two, in came two, became known as their names were Nachumson and Lulav. They were the leaders of the crew that came to arrest them, and both were from families of Hasidim, both were from families of Chabad Hasidim. In fact, it came later on that this fellow Nachumson, his parents were childless, and they went to the Rebbe before him for a bracha, and he gave him a bracha, and he was the child that was born out of that. So he was born from one of the Rebbe, but they came to arrest. Last first they attempted to do a search of the house. They sort of did a search for the house, but really they had come to arrest the Rebbe. He gave him a hard time. They came in. He said, where are are you Schneerson? He said, it's appropriate if you're in my house to refer not to call me that way. I'm either Rabbi Schneerson or drove him a little. But they after about an hour or two within the house, they took him out. Now before he left, there are two interesting things, notes that took place. One of them is that he gave a bracha to his grandson. There was a grandson that was living with them. Shmaryahu Gerari and his daughter were living in the apartment. He had a son, Shalom Dov Ber Gerari. So he gave that child a bracha before he left, saying, fearing that he might not come back, he said, "May this child grow to be the greatest of his brothers and stand firmly on the same basis of which his grandfather is standing. And Hashem, grant that he tread the same path that was boldly trodden by his holy forebears, for in his veins flows holy blood that is bequeathed from a father to a son, to his grandson, and to his great-grandson." Now, that boy was the only male descendant and remained the only male descendant of Rav Yosef Yitzchak. So he was not old enough to become Reb. He became became known as Barry Gorare later on. But that certainly, there was a secession issue. When Menachem Mendel became Rebbe, it wasn't so clear that he was going to become the Rebbe. That's a story for another time. But this bracha played a role, right? This was a bracha that was given to his grandson, whose father, the idea was, his father would take care of him until he was ready to be Rebbe. That's sort of what one gets from this idea. So that's one thing that took place. The other thing that is also an interesting note to keep track of is that Menachem Mendel happened to be in town on a date with his daughter, on a date with Chaya Mushka. They were engaged already at that point, and as they were coming back home, so they saw that there was a police car outside, so she says to him, you shouldn't come in, I'll go and see what's going on. So she goes in, she goes up to the apartment, and she calls out from the window to him, "We have guests." Now, he understood what that meant. He ran to the Gabbai's house, and they immediately started burning as many records as they possibly could. Now, there's a little bit of an issue. I mean, you read a couple different memoirs here. Was he involved in illegal activities or not? He was defiant in prison that I didn't do anything illegal, and you could check everything I did, and everything I did was within the law. You have no right to have me in prison. You have no right to punish me. You have no right to do any of these things. I was totally above the law. But yet, that's the other part of the story, is that Solo went and burnt as many records as he could before it would be found out.
The implication is that they would suspect them of financial.
Yeah. So their charges were that he was subverting Russian authority, he was subverting communist authority.
Okay.
Now, one thing that meant was that you were teaching Torah. Another thing that meant was that you were spreading money throughout the country, both in terms of funding yeshivas and things like that, and also funding people. Now, his claim was, "So what do you mean? I'm doing a great thing. I'm bringing money from America into Russia. Like, what could be a bigger mitzvah than that?" But that comes later on. Well, maybe it did, because he ended up living.
Oh, okay.
Rabbi Gross,
yes.
The fact that when they searched the house, initially didn't find any documents.
Yeah.
That was proof right there.
You mean,
they didn't find anything incriminating.
Right.
They just knew that he was the figure of Judaism in Russia. So as soon as they got him, so to speak, then they were able to dismantle Yiddishkeit.
Yeah.
And I mean, and it wasn't just about institutionalized Judaism. It was even, you know, I hear stories of people in Russia who they had to like close the blinds, the shutters, for the like candles. That's even on a personal level.
Right.
Not just like the Chadarim and the shuls. Like, they wanted like Judaism to be nothing.
Right, right. Certainly this group within the Communist Party wanted
to do that. They wanted to be more communist than that was them. But just in general, the communists in general didn't want Yiddishkeit. Of course, they had help from our own.
Right.
We're always our own, our worst. I don't think, I mean, if you want to say he did things illegal, because it was illegal to teach Torah, so of course he was doing illegal things, but he found
right.
that he would say what he was doing within communism was fine, and they searched the house and they couldn't find anything.
Right.
So,
right. It wouldn't have to be illegality to be that he would be afraid of discovery. He might have names of his top aides.
Right, that could be.
And names of Jews in the area. And
okay.
You know,
that could be right. He was hiding the evidence of who would be the next in command and what was the network and all those kind of things. Right. Okay. I'll accept that. Okay. So he was taken to a prison. The prison. I think the building still stands today. There is actually, I found today, a video that's around the internet. Someone went back and kind of videotaped what the prison looked like. I couldn't figure out what it is. I don't think it's still a prison. I don't think it became apartments. I'm not sure what it is. I think the building still stands, known as Spelunko or Spelunko. It was on Spelunko Street. And it was only a couple of blocks away from where the Rebbe lived. He went outside. He didn't want to serve people inside. He went outside to wait for the carriage to come and get him. And he packed his bag. His bag has his tefillin, his Ravina Tam tefillin, his sitter, his Tanya. He put it all in a bag and some blanket or something that he wanted to bring with him. And the story goes that as the carriage pulled up for him to go to take him to prison, so Lulav, the person who had come to arrest him, picked up the bag and said, or he gave the bag to a soldier to take. And Lulav said, "I'll take the bag because my grandfather had the zechus, had the merit of carrying a bag for your father, your grandfather. A chassid remains a chassid, and I'll carry your bag." To which he took the bag away from Lulav and said, "Your grandfather carried the bag for the Rebbe when the Rebbe was deciding where to go. Right? When you're deciding where to go, you don't get to be able to carry my bag." And he gave it back to this soldier. Now this bag became an issue as they got into prison. He kept it with him. He kept attempting to. They brought him there, and the way it's described in the book, The Heroic Struggle, this is where the book comes in. It's just a very odd setup of how he was told. He was told to go down this hallway. He ends up making the wrong turn in the hallway, even though it was filled with soldiers. There's nobody with him. He ended up sitting down on a bench and meeting somebody who. I couldn't quite get a understanding of what this. But I ended up in some sort of interrogation place where he was supposed to fill out, not really interrogation yet, he was supposed to go and fill out a form, a questionnaire about where he's coming from. He said, "I refuse to fill it out. All that I'll put down is my name is Yosef Yitzchak. I'm the Grand Rebbe of Lubavitch. I live in this address and I've done nothing wrong." And they eventually they send him off to his cell. He's processed. He's given a number, and at every point that he stops, he still has this bag with him. So he keeps asking, "I was promised that I'd be able to keep my bag and be able to have an opportunity to pray with my tefillin on. When am I going to have a chance to do that?" And the answer started coming back to him: "Is you think you're going to make a shul in Spelunko? That's not going to happen." So. I realize these were also probably people that understood, right? The idea of Hasidic thought of we go wherever we can, and mitzvahs maybe the opportunity to do a mitzvah in a specific place. You never know that maybe I'm supposed to be here for that particular reason. You could see them giving that answer, right? It's not going to happen that you're going to be able to bring Kedusha into this place. So at one point, he was like waiting in a room for the person to go on, and while the guard had his back to him, he like put on his tefillin and started davening. Then the guard turned around and he took him and he threw him down these steps. He got some kind of gash within his stomach that bled profusely. He became very weak from that. But they took away his tefillin from him at that point, and they finally brought him to his room. as he gets to his room, he says, okay, I want my bag back. I was promised my bag. And they laughed at him. Oh, you're not getting it. You're a prisoner. Don't you understand where you are? You're a prisoner now. So he said, okay, I'm hereby taking upon myself a hunger fast. I'm not going to eat. I'm not going to drink until I get my stuff back. So this was a Tuesday night going into Wednesday. Wednesday goes by, Thursday goes by, he still is not eating, he's not drinking, he gets called for interrogation late Thursday night, and he actually tells a story here. So they sit him down, they say, you know where you are? He says, yeah, I'd like to tell a story. Interrogators have their hands on their guns and their weapons, and they look at him and say, answer the question, you know, we have the questions, you know, and then the Rebbe says, listen, you know, everybody knows that everybody likes to hear stories from the Rebbe, so I'm going to tell a story. And he says, Maskil and Apikoros once visited my great-grandfather, Tzemach Tzedek. So Nachumson, who is this guy who's been there all along, he says, probably a person like me, who doesn't believe in anything. He says, no. He was a person who was well-versed in Jewish knowledge. You're somebody who doesn't know anything. Right? So this person asked the Tzemach Tzedek, why is it that in Megillah, when Mordechai sent word to the messenger, to Esther and Haman's decree, the word Yehudim is spelled out to include the letter Yud twice? That Mordechai sent a note to her with two Yuds in it. So in Perek Dalet, one of the times when Yehudim is mentioned, there's two Yuds in that word. Whereas later on in the Megillah, and really several other times in the Megillah, it's described, when it talks about the deliverance of the Jewish people, there's only one Yud. Right? There's a Kriyuk Siv about Yehudim in the Gemara. So why is it only one Yud later on? So Tzemach Tzedek replied, the two Yuds represent the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov, meaning both the evil people as well as the virtuous people contain the 10 qualities of the soul, and there are two kinds of yuds. The yud of a virtuous inclination, the yud of an evil inclination. Haman's decree wasn't only against the God-fearing Jews. It was against all of the Jews. And they too, I mean, even the non-religious Jews, they were also included in this. So the visitor then asks, so why is it then the later verse, and the Jews of Shushan gathered, once again we find the spelling of two yuds. But Samson said, because after the Jews were saved, I mean, and then they were saved, so they were saved in the merit of the tzaddik Jews. So why later on does it say two yuds again? Because after the Jews were saved, so the non-observant Jews came back, they all became Baalei Tshuva. And the Tzemach Tzedek concluded, the same is true of you. When you'll suffer greatly, then you too will change greatly. Afterwards, the Maskil was affected with fever, lasted 3 months, affected by suffering, he repented and returned to Judaism. The Rebbe concluded his narrative and then added, when you'll suffer, you too are going to change. So I'm not going to read through. Then he has a description of the interrogation. By the way, this book is he took notes right after he left. He took notes of his experience and tried to write everything down. That's not what this book is, though, because as he was running through Europe, apparently those notes were lost. But he did repeat the various of the stories later on. They came up in various stories. So the writer of this book, this Dr. Alter Metzger, so he collected things from various sources and put it together that came up with this book. So they describe, you're accused of abetting reactionary force in the USSR, you're accused of a counter-revolution, the Jews of the USSR perceive you as a prominent religious authority and you rule over them, and he answers them, I don't rule over anybody, it's true I am a prominent authority, because, well, I'm a prominent authority, what do you want from me? But I'm not, I'm not doing anything wrong, and they have this discussion going on at the end. Finally, at the end, he says, when am I going to get my tefillin back? And they tell, you know, they laugh at him again, it's not going to happen. But anyways, the inquiry concluded late that night. At the end, Lulav, who had a tendency to stammer, blurted out in anger, but, you know, you answer the questions very well, but you know in 24 hours you're going to be shot. So that was Thursday night. Friday, they gave, on Friday afternoon, they actually brought him back his tefillin and his siddurim. It was unclear what it was going to be. But they gave him back his things. They actually gave him. He said, "Okay, but I'm not going to eat any. I'm not going to eat your food. It has to be kosher." So there actually was a rule in the prison that people were able to bring in food from the outside on Fridays. Like that was the rule. But it depended on what the food was. If it was food that, so for instance, bread came in, but they would chop it up to make sure you weren't including anything in the bread. But he was given three whole challahs, which was unusual. But they were able. They worked it out, and he was able to have those three challahs. He had a suda that night. With his challahs, and he made kiddush on the challah, and it had water that was going through the place. and he had a couple of more interrogations as the days go on. Now, what was going on the outside? What was going on the outside? So when he left, when he was being arrested, he told his family, you don't have to get involved with what others will do. You should go and seek out your private contacts to intercede on my behalf. Word got out very quickly that the Rebbe was being taken for prison. Even while he was sitting on the street waiting to be picked up, there were people who were coming by and finding him and things like that, and saw what was going on. And people knew right away what was going on. There was a machlokas. People got in touch with their contacts in Moscow. There was a discussion, should we tell the whole world? Or should we not tell the whole world? There was concern that if we tell the whole world, they might just shoot him on the spot. You know, they're not going to get involved with the whole world complaining. But as soon as they found out, and somehow they found out that Friday, that there was a verdict that he was going to be killed, so then they let everybody know. There were letters and telegrams that came in the next week. He was not killed that night. He was given a stay. There was a person that was involved, a Madame Peshkova, who was the head of the Red Cross in Russia. So she was a major connector in terms of the efforts in order to free him. And they were able to hold off. And after the third interrogation, they told him, okay, you're going to be sent to Siberia for 10 years. You're going to get 10 years of hard labor. And that's the verdict. Word got out to the Hasidim that that was going to be the verdict. They said that's not good enough. He's not going to be able to survive 10 years in Siberia. We need to do better. And then the verdict came back that fine, we'll give him 3 years in this... someplace. 3 years in a place called Kostroma. Kostroma is not so far. It looks like it's a 10-hour drive. On Google Maps, it's a 10-hour drive from St. Petersburg. That's what I discovered today. But he saw on his sheet of paper, on his way out, he saw his sheet of paper where it actually said death sentence, yet, meaning it's not going to be a death sentence. Then he said 10 years of hard labor, and then it said no next to that again. And then it says 3 years in this place called 3 years of exile in this place, Kostroma. So we are now up to Sunday, July 3rd. So it's been 2 weeks. Actually, it was a couple days before. That was told to him on June gets 30 days. So on June 30th, he was told, you're going to go to Kostroma. He said, well, I can't. When's the next train? He said, well, the train leaves on Shabbos. I'm not going on Shabbos. Well, you're going to have to stay in jail for next. Okay, fine. So he stays in jail over Shabbos again in order to avoid going. That Sunday, they let him go home for a few. It's all like a little odd, this whole way of jail work. But they sent him home for a few hours, saying, go collect your stuff, and then you're going to go off to this place. So he bought, they said, they had a rule that any money that you had on you got put into an account when you got into jail. So if you want to send a telegram to somebody, they deducted it from your account. So they said, what class train ticket do you want to get to this place? So I'm only going to take the highest, the Rebbe travels in class, international rate. So yeah, you have the money to pay for it? Yeah, it'll be covered. So he takes this high-level train ticket. It doesn't get into what the significance of that is, other than that the Rebbe, I think, generally would travel in this first class. So that Sunday he goes home for a few hours. His future son-in-law, Menachem Mendel, goes with him, as well as Chaya Mushka, who, again, they weren't married yet, they were only engaged at the time. Mm-hmm. They accompany him on this 24-hour train ride, even though it's a 10-hour car ride in 2018, but it's a 24-hour train ride in the year 1927. And he accompanies him to this place. Another chassid went beforehand. I mean, they knew he was going there. So chassid went beforehand to set up a cheder and to make sure that the mikveh was in good shape in this place. There was this place. There was a shul in this town. There were about 100 Jews that lived there. And when he arrived, there was a reception. The 100 Jews in town came and said, like wow, we the Lubavitcher Rebbe is going to be living here for the next couple of years. Like, to what do we get that merit? But they, after a couple of days, they interceded, and he was actually told that he was going to be sent back. So on Tuesday, the 12th of Tammuz, he was...
You said they interceded.
The Hasidim throughout the world and all the other governments. It gets into some of the details here about the inns, who had inns with who and who called...
Just Hasidim in the Soviet Union.
No, they got letters from congressmen and senators in America. People got the...
Wow.
The thousands of letters came. That's the way it's described. The 12th of Tammuz, Tuesday, is when he got freed. So the 12th of Tammuz, Ara Yom Hazeh, is known as a holiday. The 12th of Tammuz, Chabad don't say Tachlin on that day. That's when the Friedrich Rebbe got out of jail, as opposed to when the Alter Rebbe got out of jail. But but that is still considered an important day. And he goes home. So he gets a few months, but he realizes very quickly that this is not going to work, and he starts making arrangements to try to leave Russia. Now I don't know what happened with that oath that was taken. I don't know if there's a pshat in that, if you can find out from that. I mean, he had made this oath with the other nine people that were going to defend Judaism here until the last drop. I'm wondering when he left, he did assume, and he tried to, still be the Rebbe for Russian Jewry. I mean, he tried to still be the conduit for which money was going to get in, but we're getting ahead of ourselves for a second as the story continues here. So he had to figure out a way to get out. So there were already involved in trying to get him free in the first place, Rav Hildesheimer, as well as some others in Berlin, were trying to get him out, as well as the Jewish community in Riga. Riga is in Latvia today. It's right on the other side of the Russian of the Russian border. And these two both of them, they weren't working with each other. Both of them sent people to Moscow to try to get him out. And it might have worked better that they didn't meet up with each other, but they said, let's still continue to pretend that we're adversaries, and that way maybe we'll have a better chance. Because both of them brought pressure, saying, you better not have... And they both came with offers for him to become the rabbi of the town. That he become the rabbi in Berlin, or he become the rabbi in Riga. And both of them said, you better not let him become the rabbi in Berlin, because it's going to be very embarrassing to us if we couldn't get him, and they did get him. So the Riga community had a little bit more leverage, apparently, because somebody very high up in the Jewish community worked in the worked for the Secretary of Agriculture, or was very high up in the and was in the middle of trying to cut some kind of deal with the Russian government at the time. So he goes to Moscow, and he's given big kavod, and he's given the great places to stay, and he's given much honor and respect, and he says, listen, if you want this deal to go through, you better let the Rebbe be able to leave, and he's going to come the rabbi in Riga. Ultimately, that's what happened. And he ended up leaving the day after Sukkot. He left with his entire family, including his daughter and future son-in-law, as well as six Hasidim as well. Don't know if it was their entire family. And his library. Now, the Chabad library is a big deal. Like, that is became subject to some controversy later on. But the Chabad, the Alter Rebbe, going all the way back to the Alter Rebbe, that sort of became the symbol of who the real Lubavitcher Rebbe is. Whoever has possession of this library, they left with all of his stuff. So it said in the book that it took up four train cars. These people, plus all of the library, and plus all of the stuff that they brought with them. They end up in Riga. The famous picture, there's one very famous picture of the Rebbe sitting. This is probably the most famous picture of Rebbe Yitzchak. That's him sitting at his desk in Riga. He had a desk there. He was there it seemed like he was only there for a year. Wasn't really. He tried sort of continuing his efforts on behalf of Russian Jewry, but it didn't really work out the way he anticipated. He wasn't building up a court there, and he tried now setting up sites for where should I reestablish the Lubavitch Hasidus? Yeah.
I'm sorry, there isn't an expert around thinking about Russian history.
What do you mean?
But I'm not so sure that Riga was in Latvia was part of Russia at that time.
No, it wasn't.
It was not.
It was not.
It was not.
Okay.
It was an independent country.
Yeah, okay.
Riga, Latvia. In 1928.
Oh, yeah. That was the Latvia.
Right. So,
yeah,
whatever.
If
they had to negotiate with the Russians about getting him out anyway, it introduces another...
Right, so he ends up there.
They did, though, so... Yeah.
Did he try to get any of his chassidim to leave with him and went from?
I don't think. My impression is that it just wasn't going to happen. He wrote them a letter as he was leaving. He did. Also different stories about whether he told them or didn't tell them about whether he was leaving beforehand, but certainly he left notes to them saying that, you know, that I want you to stay strong and all these kinds of things, but yeah.
Common expression. You weren't letting anyone out.
Yeah.
It's a miracle that
I was asking if he tried to smuggle out any of his chassidim.
Well, he brought these six, but he didn't bring... I found that he refused to leave without his family, but then also says that his son, Menachem Mendel, came 3 days later, which I was surprised he would leave much... Whatever, but he...
another question?
Yeah.
Before Rav Yosef was arrested...
I thought I had another 10 minutes.
Were other chassidim being arrested and interrogated and, I assume, tortured?
I don't know.
To Siberia?
Yeah, I don't know. I assume yes. Yes. Yes, definitely there were.
So there's a question then. He's saying, don't leave, we're going to stay here. Some of his chassidim are being arrested, tortured, interrogation, tortured, and perhaps sent out. He says, stay. But as soon as it happens to him, he says, I'm going.
Right. So I think the idea was that there was no chance that he was going to survive, that he would be able to stay.
But it wasn't... enough of a problem.
Well, it wasn't an option. It wasn't an option. This is something we could discuss in future years. This was a general issue with rebbes in Europe, the ones that got out. A lot of them left their chassidim behind. And that's a challenging thing to deal with, what happened. I think in this case, it wasn't an option to leave. It wasn't like in some other cases where they were telling everybody to stay and be strong. As, you know,
like in Hungary, for example.
Yeah, I realized Mincha is in 2 minutes. I thought I had 12 minutes, but I'll just give the Roshei Tevos of the end part that I wanted to mention. In 1930, he goes to Eretz Yisrael, tries thing there, and then ends up doing a tour in America. Actually, was welcomed by Herbert Hoover in the White House. Actually, had a meeting with Herbert Hoover, and actually ended up in Philadelphia. There is a little, you can find it online. I found this today that he ended, there's a famous picture of him in Philadelphia, and he was given the great cover by the mayor at that time. Of sitting in George Washington's chair in Independence Hall. That's like the big cover. He sat and laid a wreath at the Liberty Bell, which at that time was in the other room of Independence Hall. But that room, that chair with the sun on it, the sun chair, so apparently the Rebbe sat in that chair and then addressed everybody, etc., went back to Europe, tried developing things there, things didn't really work out, ended up back in America in 1940. Famous story is there's a famous picture. This famous picture is him coming off the boat in America. And the famous story goes that as soon as he got off the boat, he said, I need a week to rest up, figure things out. And he was given a place in a hotel in Manhattan. Then the chassidim told him, listen, you know, we'll try to do what we can for you, but there's really no future for you here in America. And he turned to the chassidim and said, you know, where I come from, the Rebbe tells the chassidim what to do, not the other way around. We're starting things up, ends up going to Crown Heights, which at that time was the most prominent, was the wealthiest Jewish community in the area. Right across the street from the biggest conservative temple in the area, and said we're getting started, and the rest is history.
Just 2 points. The Rebbe famously said, America is nicht anders, America is not different. We're going to make this place a Jewish place. Mm-hmm. The thing is that there's an incredible escape of the Friedrich Rebbe from Warsaw by the Germans themselves. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
He was living in Warsaw, and so he was freed miraculously from the communism.
Right, I came across that today. There's another whole story about how he got out of Poland even after the Nazis had already invaded. Yes, so that's the other part of the story, how he was able to get out there.
All right.
Thank you.